This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
We've been talking about this case for literally about 3 years, since we started this program is when a lot of this went down. And we've analyzed every angle of this thing, from her innocence to her guilt. We all know what the facts say now. So it's interesting to go back down those paths that we once visited, where we speculated on innocence or guilt, and see where the blocks have been put into place now, and what that structure looks like factually, now that we have more of a definitive answer as to what was truly going on with Corey Richens and Eric Richens and their children and those around leading up to her conviction in court earlier in the year. It's going to be fascinating. So if you've been watching this story, if you've been following along, or maybe you've heard bits and pieces and you're like, I really want to grasp this whole damn thing. This is a place to do. This is part one in our 5-part series that we're going to break down the whole case, all of it, start to finish, who these people are, who they were, and what drove them to do what they did. All the pieces working together in some sort of hellish harmony that created what it did. And as we do, I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. In April of 2023, a woman sat on the set of Good Things Utah, a local morning show in Salt Lake City, and talked about grief. She was poised. She was sympathetic. She had prepared talking points about how to help children cope with losing a parent. Even had a promo code, so viewers could buy her self-published children's book, Are You With Me? She told the hosts she wrote the book with her kids to help them process the unexpected death of their father. The oldest was 10. She said it brought a little peace to her and her boys. And look, I mean, if that's authentic and real, yeah, I mean, that's, wow. That's a really interesting way, and it sounds like effective way at working through grief with your kids and helping them through it and bonding at the same time. She described the past year as an exercise in survival, navigating first holidays, anniversaries, birthdays, all without the man that she'd married. The only problem is she didn't write the book with her kids or herself, even. A ghostwriter did. For $2,500. And in a text message to her brother, she admitted the book was really just practice, something to help her understand the book writing process to get ready for the big one. You know, like gymnasts do when they go to children's playgrounds and play on monkey bars before they get on the big ones and swing around and throw people up in the air with no net. Oh, wait, that's not how that works. Just like having a ghostwriter create a children's mainly illustrative picture book is somehow an exercise in getting you to writing a novel. Yeah, that makes sense, Corey. But as you'll learn, the through line through this story, as it is in so many of the stories, dumbass is certainly there. And lying narcissist is also a big through line in this story. And as I say on all cases, narcissism always wins. Without fail, narcissism always wins. But Tony, she's going away for the rest of her life. You're right. You know why? Narcissism won. It took over her. It took over her life. It took over her thinking. It took over everything that she does, and it won. It destroyed her. That is what narcissism does. It doesn't make the narcissist win. No, they're the ones who always lose. At the end of the day, when all is said and done, it falls apart. It goes to shit. It's the end when it's the end. Usually far earlier than it needs to be for the narcissists. But the destruction that they create practicing the narcissism, it certainly has its effect, and it takes its course, and this one certainly has. The children's book about her dead husband, the husband she killed, was a dress rehearsal for a bigger payday. That woman was Corey Richens, and the performance she gave on that morning show was just the last in a long series of performances that defined her entire adult life. Every smile was calculated, every tear was optional, and the grief she performed so convincingly on camera was the same grief she manufactured in a $2,500 purchase order to a ghostwriter. Like I said, this is part one of her five-part series, the definitive Corey Richens story. Hi, Corey, as you're watching us from a jail cell, I know she is. Why? Because narcissists can't get enough of their own publicity, even if it's shitty. Hope it works out well for you. Heard they got Skittles at the commissary every Wednesday. Better save your pennies. I'm going to tell your story start to finish. You probably are not going to want to continue because this is, you might get a narcissistic injury, Corey. You don't want to stub your big toe. That might hurt a little bit. Be stubbing more than that, by the way. Over the next five episodes, we're going to be taking this case apart piece by piece. The fraud that built her empire, the affair, and the fentanyl that fueled her plan. The night she mixed that final drink, the 14-month cover-up she staged from a TV studio to a jail cell, and the verdict that ended it all. No other coverage has told the story in this sort of way. We're going to be starting at the foundation. Who Corey Richens really was before she ever became a defendant, because context is important. And as you know, we like getting deep into the psychology of the people we talk about on this show. So, on March 16th, 2026, a jury in Summit County, Utah, convicted Corey Richens of aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, forgery, and two counts of insurance fraud in connection with the death of her husband, Eric Richens. They deliberated for less than 3 hours. She bowed her head when the verdict was read. She faces 25 years to life in prison or life without the possibility of parole. But to understand how a suburban mother of three ended up sitting in a courtroom hearing, the word guilty repeated five times, you have to understand the mask she wore long before she ever mixed that final drink. Because the murder wasn't where this story started. The murder was where the mask finally cracked. Corey Darden. Yes, Darden before Richens, her maiden name, grew up in Utah. Her father went to prison. Her mother was an alcoholic. She grew up cleaning houses for wealthy families in Park City, scrubbing toilets, making beds, watching other people live the kind of life she wanted. And she told herself one day she'd own those homes. That ambition by itself isn't a character flaw. Plenty of people come from nothing and build something real through hard work and discipline and the kind of resilience that adversity sometimes forges. I get it. But Corey didn't build. She performed. She created the appearance of success. Well, the foundation underneath was made of fraud, forgery, and someone else's money. She wanted the lifestyle without the substance, the reputation without the track record, the wealth without the work. Let's meet Eric Richens, a man who had everything she wanted to project. Eric co-owned CNE Masonry, a successful stonemasonry business that he'd built with his own hands. He was an outdoorsman, a hunter, a cattleman, the kind whose obituary would describe him as dedicated to his family and happiest with dirt under his fingernails. He had real money, real stability, and a real reputation in the community that came from years of honest work. His sisters described him as a man who loved his boys fiercely, who coached them, hunted with them, who was building a life centered around them, not around image or status. He was the kind of father who showed up, the kind of husband who, even when his marriage was failing, stayed for his children because he believed that's what a man does. When he finally realized how dangerous Corey was, he didn't run. He built a legal fortress around his kids. That's who Eric Richens was. Not a footnote in a murder case, a person, a father, a man who deserved to watch his boys grow up. They married on June 15th of 2013 in the backyard of their home in Utah. They already had one son together. Two more would follow. And on their wedding day, they signed a document that would become the most important piece of evidence in a murder trial 13 years later, a prenuptial agreement. The terms were straightforward. Neither party had rights to each other's present or future income, property, or assets. If they divorced, they walked away with what they came in with. Corey came in with nothing, which meant she'd leave with nothing. But there was one exception buried in the language, a single clause that would change everything. If Eric died while they were lawfully married, Corey would inherit his estate, his business, his properties, his accounts, everything. Divorce equaled zero. Death equaled millions. The clause wasn't a legal technicality. It was a loaded weapon. Sitting in a filing cabinet. And Corey knew exactly where it was. She'd signed it, she'd agreed to it, and at some point she decided to use it. For a few years, the marriage looked functional enough from the outside. They had three boys, lived in Commerce, Utah, a quiet mountain town about 40 miles southeast of Salt Lake City. Not far from the ski resort culture of Park City, Eric ran his masonry business. Corey projected the image of a busy, ambitious wife and mother. Friends described them as having what appeared to be a comfortable life. But comfortable wasn't enough for Corey. She didn't want comfort. She wanted status. She wanted the version of success she'd seen growing up in other people's houses, the kind that comes with a big address and a bigger reputation. Eric's steady blue-collar prosperity wasn't the life she'd imagined for herself, and so in 2019, she decided to build her own empire. That's when the cracks became canyons. K. Richens Realty was a house flipping business. The concept was simple. Buy properties, renovate them, sell them for profit. Looks super easy on HGTV. In real life, the execution's a little more complex. Just a little. The execution was catastrophic. To fund it, Corey took out a $250,000 home equity line of credit against the family home, but she didn't tell her husband. She didn't tell Eric. You know, who bought the home with his money. Prosecutors allege she used his power of attorney to take out the HELOC without his knowledge, putting the roof over their children's head on the line so she could fund a business she had no demonstrated ability to manage. Eric's brother-in-law, Clint Benson, testified that when Eric eventually found out about the HELOC, he was very upset and sad. Benson said they discussed divorce attorneys that same day. That's the point at which Eric Richens began trying to protect himself from his own wife. And that protection would ultimately prove to be both very persistent and heartbreaking. The business grew faster than Corey could control it. One property in 2019 became 15 simultaneous renovation projects by 2021, totaling more than $6.7 million in real estate purchases. She was juggling contractors, lenders, timelines, and budgets on a scale that would challenge a seasoned developer with a full team and deep pockets. Corey was neither seasoned nor solvent. She was a woman with ambition, no guardrails, and a dangerous willingness to bet other people's money on her own optimism and lack of experience. The numbers tell the story better than any narrative ever could. Between January of 21 and March of 2022, Corey attempted 236 overdraft transactions, more than $300,000 in bounced checks written to contractors who'd done work for her in good faith. Her business account racked up nearly $6,000 in fees just from rejected transactions. She tried to pay herself $60,000 and the transaction was rejected because the account was empty. She lost over $900,000 across the properties she managed to sell. When you subtract contractor costs, closing fees, and K. carrying expenses. By the time Eric died in March of 2022, forensic accountant Brooke Carrington testified that Corey owed approximately $7.5 million in total debt and was paying roughly $80,000 per month to her lenders. Carrington told the jury that Corey's financial enterprise was collapsing and had been collapsing, and but for a significant confusion of cash and capital, would have continued to collapse. She used a word that stuck: imploding. If Corey had sold everything she owned, Carrington said, it would have not been enough to get back to zero. And here's where the prenup re-enters the picture. Corey was drowning. Her business was hemorrhaging money faster than she could borrow it. Her contractors were getting bounced checks. Her lenders were circling. She couldn't leave Eric because the prenup guaranteed she'd walk away with nothing. She couldn't stay and keep pretending because the facade was cracking and Eric was starting to notice exactly where his money was going. She was trapped in a marriage she needed financially but couldn't sustain personally, in a business that was consuming her faster than she could feed it. And the only exit that actually paid was the one written into her wedding contract. Eric Richens was not a man who missed things forever. In fall of 2020, he discovered the scope of what Corey had been doing with his finances. He found the unauthorized HELOC. He found spending he hadn't approved. He discovered debt she'd been accumulating in his name and against his assets, debt he never authorized and didn't know existed. And he did something that in hindsight may have been the bravest and most consequential decision of his life. He quietly went to see a divorce attorney. Then he went to see an estate planning lawyer named Crystal Bowman Carter. Bowman Carter's testimony at the trial was devastating in its simplicity. He said Eric came to her with two goals. First, he wanted to protect himself from fairly recently discovered and ongoing abuse and misuse of his finances by his wife. Second, he wanted to protect his three sons by ensuring Corey would never be in a position to manage his property after his death. Eric created the Eric Richens Living Trust. He named his sister Katie Richens Benson as trustee. He removed Corey as a beneficiary of his $500,000 life insurance policy. He transferred his home and business interests into the trust. He did all of this without telling Corey a single thing because the man she married no longer trusted her with his money, his legacy, or his children's future. He was building a firewall between his family and his wife, and he didn't even tell her it existed. But Corey didn't know. She had no idea that the estate she was counting on, the one the prenup was supposed to guarantee her if Eric died, had been placed beyond her reach. She was still operating under the assumption that death equaled inheritance. That the prenup was her golden ticket, that if Eric stopped breathing, she'd start living the life she'd been performing for years. She'd done the math. She looked at the insurance policies. She looked at the estate. She looked at the debt. And she decided that the only number that made everything work was zero. Eric Richens' pulse. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth framed it in his closing arguments with a line that should follow this case into every textbook, every podcast, every conversation about what happens when narcissism meets financial desperation. Corey Richens is an intensely ambitious person. She is a risk taker. There was a way forward. Eric had to die. That is who Corey Richens was before the murder. Before the fentanyl, before the Moscow mule, before the children's book and the TV appearance and the jail cell letter and the Google searches she couldn't even spell correctly. She was a woman who built a life on borrowed money and forged signatures, who projected an image of success while the real numbers were catastrophic, and who had exactly one exit strategy left. Eric Richens wasn't her husband. He was the insurance policy. And when he tried to protect himself and his children from her, She didn't adjust. She didn't come clean. She didn't accept that the game was over. She accelerated her plan to cash him in. The mask was flawless. The woman underneath it was not. In part two, we followed the plan, the secret affair, the forged insurance policies, the fentanyl. She bought at a gas station through her housekeeper, and a Valentine's Day poisoning attempt that should have been the warning nobody could ignore. Eric Richens told his family, if anything happens to me, she did it. Oh, nobody stopped her in time. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We're going to continue to work through this. Part two is coming up next. I don't want you to miss it. If you want to get at it right now, you can. There's a couple options for you. You can become a member on our YouTube channel. Link is in the description. You can get it also through Apple Podcasts if you become a member there as well. You get advanced episodes ad-free. So do indeed check that out. Again, links are in the description. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.